The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Case 33, San Sheng's Golden Fish, the pointer. Meeting the strong, be weak. Meeting the soft, be hard. If both are hard and hit each other, there will surely be one damaged. But tell me, how do you interchange? The main case. San Sheng asked Zhui Feng, the golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food? Zhui Feng said, when you come out of the net, then I'll tell you. San Sheng said, the teacher of 1,500 people, yet you don't even know a saying. Zhui Feng said, my tasks as abbot are many. Hong Zhe's verse. When first ascending the tiers of waves, clouds and thunder accompany, leaping up magnificently, look at the great function. With a burnt tail, he clearly crosses the gate of you. The beautiful fish won't agree to be sunk in a pickle jar. An old, mature person doesn't startle a crowd. Someone used to facing a great adversary has no fear from the start. Floating, floating, just as light as 5 ounces. Massive, massive, heavier than even 1,000 tons. San Sheng's exalted fame over the four seas. Who again was his peer? Zhui Feng stands alone. The 8 winds blowing did not move him. I gave a talk recently on San Sheng, who was a disciple of Lin Ji. And then there's Zhui Feng, who is through the line of Dongshan. So these are two different teachers in two different lineages meeting each other. And the pointer, meeting the strong be weak, meeting the soft be hard. If both are hard and hit each other, there will be some damage. How do you interchange? The teachings talk a lot about being free and unbound. Sometimes appearing as a soft autumn breeze and sometimes like a raging fire. On the Bodhisattva path, the question is, what is needed? What will be helpful? In the Lotus Sutra, one of the disciples asked the Buddha, how does the Bodhisattva perceiver of the world's sounds, Avalokiteshvara, come and go in this Saha world? How does their expedient means benefit other beings? How do they show up? The Buddha said, this is just a very short piece of what he said. If there are living beings in the land who need a heavenly being, or a householder, or a monastic, or a young person, or a dragon, or a human, or a non-human being, then the Bodhisattva becomes that being and offers their service in that very way. They bestow fearlessness on those who are fearful, who are in pressing or difficult circumstances. This is why Avalokiteshvara is known as the bestower of fearlessness. You know, the teachings point so much to attachments, clinging, grasping. And we can see the obvious forms of that, or we come to see the obvious forms of that when we're clearly grasping and don't want to let go of something. But there's so many subtle ways in which attachment and clinging takes place within the body and mind. And the closer we look, we see that that makes us very inflexible, rigid, fixed. whatever it is that we're grasping onto, doesn't affect the thing, perhaps unless it's a person or a living thing. But of course, we can't grasp onto an object. If I'm attached to this, kutz, the attachment is not in the stick, it's not in my hand. The stick is the same, whether I'm attached to it or not. But that attachment makes me less flexible, less pliant. It limits me, one, because of that fixation on this attachment. It doesn't allow me to understand or see or meet the stick. It also doesn't allow me to give it to you. And so Avalokiteshvara is a manifestation because of compassion, out of compassion, who just assumes whatever shape is needed, responds however is needed. It's not about her so much as what will be helpful. And so we practice letting go of whatever we're attached to. And it's when we're clinging, when we're grasping, that we really develop, strengthen, bring to full power our ability to be non-grasping. And we understand how to let go of all of the plethora, the vast range of things that we attach to, because while the essential, the basis of attachment is the same, and in a sense the letting go is the same, the path is not. The path to letting go. Sometimes the path to letting go begins with recognizing, I don't want to let go. And maybe that's just where it is at that moment. Or, I don't want to let go, but I want to let go. I don't yet, but I want to want that. That opens a door. And so we let go into this Dharma body, this body of reality, so that when we meet the day, we're not meeting it in some sort of fixed form. And to think of Kanon, to think of our practice as bestowing fearlessness, what a wonderful thing to bring into the world. And of course, to bestow fearlessness or compassion or loving kindness or clarity or patience, we have to have that within ourselves. Which is another way of saying it just puts us right on the spot, which is pretty much where we need to be. In the book that we're reading on karma, Kelgren says, karma is really created through mental fixation, getting too enamored with our concepts and ideas, thoughts, projections, our tendency to reify all that we think about. By contemplating emptiness, we can loosen the grip of mind's fixation. Remember, the Buddha said after his enlightenment, as he sort of scanned with his omniscient eye all of humanity, he thought, I don't know, people are so enchanted with their attachments, they're so enamored, I don't know that anyone would be interested in giving them up. But there were a few, turns out. So when we contemplate emptiness as a contemplation or reflection, when we realize it, we see through the illusion of grasping that even the very idea, let alone the act of attachment, is really like, is an illusion. That's why the metaphor of a magic show, right? There's something going on. We see it, we feel it, other people experience it, but really, it's like a sleight of mind. Because the very idea of attachment itself is empty of attachment. The thing that we're attaching to cannot be grasped. The thing that we're seeking by attaching a certain pleasure or certain satisfaction that too is empty and can never be found if we look for it. And of course, it's all impermanent. That's why there are teachings about cautioning us about being overly fixated on experiences, Dharma experiences, practice-based experiences. Because there's a sense that if I just have a certain kind of experience, then it'll just wash everything clean, or it'll just set me up for life or something. But experiences, even important experiences, experiences that naturally occur in practice, are themselves impermanent. They come and they go. And so in the poem, when he talks about an old, mature person doesn't startle the crowd, being used to facing adversity, they have that fearlessness. And that's really an element, is talking about training, being used to facing adversity. So in practice, we come in from life having experienced adversity, but in training, there is a rigor intentionally so that we have to face what we do in the face of rigors, adversity, not getting what we want, not being with who we want. So you're sitting next to somebody who breathes too loud, right? You'd like to be sitting next to somebody else who's not breathing so loud, but you don't get that. What do we do when we face that which we do not want? What do we do when we face something that we find difficult inside, outside? Because it's only in that that we can develop our skills, that we can discover the way in. How? Floating, just as light as 5 ounces. Because the more we cling to that idea and the desire that we're not getting, and why, and who is this joker anyway, and it's not getting lighter, it's getting heavier. And once we've seen that, and we've learned how to lighten our load, then massive, heavier than even 1,000 tons, is that mountain of stability. Knowing where you sit, knowing your mind, not being so dependent upon the perfect conditions. What are those anyway? The conditions that we think are perfect tend to put us to sleep or just affirm what we already know. And so here Sanqing asks Zhuifeng, the golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food? So someone who has passed through the net of entanglements, passed through the net of false ideas and grasping at a sense of self, now what do they eat? You know, it's interesting how, it's not really what the koan's about, but it's interesting how we all come into practice motivated by whatever we're motivated by. And that motivates us. So what happens as we're practicing and practice is actually being effective? And the source of that motivation, whatever it was that was not working or upsetting us or disturbing our peace or whatever it might be, as that begins to be resolved or shift, now what motivates you? And it's a real thing. It happens pretty commonly, kind of regularly, at a certain point along the way, where particularly if the motivation was suffering, you know, something that's very strong, it's in your face, you know it, it keeps you alert, you can't ignore it, it's a steady reminder, got a lot of juice in it. And what happens is that begins to abate, is that's just not the prevalent force in your life. Very often what happens is people flounder. Where they think, well, that was good, guess I got what I came for. But perhaps not yet. And so what does this golden fish eat when it's come out of the net? In the commentary it says, in posing this question, San Xing sets out a bowl of glue in a forest of thorns. And this is a way of talking about how these are two clear-eyed masters having this conversation, but how that bowl of glue, the forest of thorns, is the adversity. And in training, you just show up and it's coming, right? Get up at 4 o'clock. Let's start there. Whatever it might be for you. And hopefully there are ample sources of discomfort to keep you lively. If not, just let us know. But that's rarely necessary, right? Why? Because we pretty much bring them with us. He says, Zhuefeng at first is 30 steps away, watching you. Look in yourself and drawing yourself out. Kind of interesting that the teacher here, Zhuefeng, stands 30 steps back and observes the self of the student being drawn out by the self of the student. So the student can see. But of course, remaining 30 steps away can't last. They have to meet intimately. To help someone, to be of service, to respond in whatever form is necessary, we have to be standing on the same ground. And here, San Xing too is observing Zhuefeng. They recognize each other. They see each other. We might say that in this dialogue, nothing is not right. How does Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva meet Kenon Bodhisattva? What kind of conversation do they have? How do they help each other? So Zhuefeng says, when you come out of the net, then I'll tell you. And the footnote says, when you meet someone, only say 30% for the time being. You know, it's a characteristic of the Chan Zen tradition, which you probably noticed, that very often the teachings don't tell you enough. They seem to leave you hungry, which is their point. That's why it's said if a teacher says too much, all of their eyebrows fall out. Only say 30% for the time being. Dharma teaching is a pointing to the mind, to the heart, to the nature of the self. And so, in a sense, the teachings leave traces, clues, that the student has to examine, reflect on, practice, realize. And it's because there's only 30%, because the teacher doesn't say it all, that we're invited in. And we're invited into our mind, into ourselves. And what's interesting is if the student is not, you know, teachers often say when the student is ready, the teacher appears. If the student is not ready, they don't even get hear 30%. They just don't hear it, which is fine. It's just not time yet. And as we grow up in this Dharma and become more clear, 30% can seem indulgent. So there's a saying, you lift up one corner and see under the other three. So when does the student pass through the net? With one realization? With many insights? Is it sufficient? Does it happen with small insights? Does it have to happen with great insights? What is the net? Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche said, it makes no sense to think, I practiced for 1 year, will I have realization? Or I practiced for 5 years or 10 years, or I've done 5 sessions, or I've done 50 sessions, will that bring me realization? He said, it makes no sense to think this way. He said, just think, if I die, that will be that. So until then, I'll just practice wholeheartedly. Makes things very simple. You don't have to get into all of that, you know, calculation. If I die, that will be that. So until then, know what to do. Hearing the words awakening, liberation, enlightenment, big words, fat words, juicy words, enticing words, inviting you in, as they should, as they should. But they just can become a net. So does that mean we never speak the words? Of course not. In the book that we're studying, Capgras talks about the importance of loving kindness. And we talked about this recently in the Mondo, earlier in the Ango. But to really look at that, what is the relationship? The Buddha said there are three trainings. The discipline, which generally means the precepts, sort of cleaning up our house, getting our house in order, to cease from causing harm, right? To follow the precepts, to live a moral life. And then calming the mind, that makes sense to pretty much everybody if you're going to meditate. If it doesn't, you probably won't. And then prajna. But sila, the discipline, is also an expression of compassion. It is being compassionate. So what is the relationship between compassion and wisdom? Why does he say that the Buddha taught the meditations on loving kindness, the four immeasurables, sending and receiving, the metta sutta, all of these different practices, and not just meditations, not just teachings, but how we actually live, what we do with each other, and why that is considered as essential along the path to realizing wisdom, just as cultivating wisdom is essential all along the way to bringing forth compassion. Why? Radiating kindness over the entire world, upwards to the skies, downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. If we're not cultivating loving kindness and compassion, what are we cultivating? If we don't have that coming forth within us, what do we have coming forth? If we want to be cultivating, bringing forth peace, and we are not at peace, and we are not cultivating peace, then how is that supposed to work? And so, whether standing, walking, seated, lying down, free from drowsiness, we should sustain this recollection, sustain it, practice it, step by step, day by day, moment by moment, by not holding to fixed views. The pure-hearted one has a clarity of vision, is freed from the grasping at sense desires, and is not born again into this world right now. Why does Zhuefeng say, when you come out of the net, then I'll tell you? Why doesn't he tell him right now? The commentary says, Sancheng, seeing that at this stage, victory and defeat are not distinguished. He went by a different route. Very interesting. Seeing that winning and losing are not being distinguished, are not being set up by Xuefeng. He went a different route. And so he said, you're the teacher of 1,500 people, but you don't even know how to say something. My tasks as abbot are many. Where is the net now? Is he complaining? Is he bragging? Where is the net now? They really can only nod to each other. Criticism and defense are no longer needed. When we sit, something appears. A sensation in your leg. You notice it. You name it, pain. You remember it. Without trying, there are associations that populate the mind like lightning. There's anticipation. What's going to happen next? Where's this going? How bad will it get? What will I do? I used to imagine ambulances driving up the driveway, stretchers being brought in. And I had experienced lots of pain in my life. I'd played sports. I'd done lots of things, like consciously, voluntarily putting myself in difficult situations that were painful, would be painful. I knew it was coming. There it was. And so I thought, I have a kind of a okay relationship with pain. Right? It's not like I've, you know, done whatever I could to never experience it. And yet, something about sitting on that naked cushion in stillness, so boldly, brought all of that history out, all of those concerns, all of those fears. So I mentioned before the one time I was sitting and I was in a lot of pain. And I was sitting there just waiting for the period in, waiting for the period in. And I thought, this is not right practice. Right? I'm not practicing. Just waiting. And so in my mind, I said, the period has just begun. Or it's got 30 more minutes. Which I knew was not true, but I made it convincing. And in that, I couldn't wait. Right? It was too long to wait. Of course, I could get up and walk out. That was an option. But my ego would not have permitted that. Thank you, ego. Holding me on that cushion, sometimes it's very useful. But what that did, of course, I was making this up. But it wasn't the only thing I was making up. I was making up a whole lot of stuff right then. And so I decided, well, if I'm going to make something up, make up something useful. So I thought, I've 30 minutes, you can't wait. Right? You have to just do this thing. That which is massive, massive. How can I make it light, light as 5 ounces? What am I doing with my mind right now? The proliferation, the fear, the anticipation, the stories, the images. It's a full-blown thing going on. What if I don't? What if I turn towards that net with the faith or the trust or the desperate need that it be something else? It's not what it appears to be. Now what is it? You know, we work so hard to work through karma, to let go of our attachments, to open our hearts, to clarify our mind, to atone for past actions, to forgive what needs to be forgiven. And for most of us, I think, a lot of the time we're hoping and waiting for the time where there's no more obstacles, no more entanglements, it's all done, no more net. And it's not that that's entirely wrong, but it's not entirely right either. It's right for a while, and then it's not right anymore. In other words, it's right in the sense that it will help us for a while. And then we'll see. We'll get to the point where it's not really helping us, because we're at a point where something more is needed. Avalokiteshvara needs to take another form. You yourself need to take another form. The object, the net, needs to take another form. Or no form at all, perhaps. When first ascending, the tears of waves, clouds, and thunder accompany, leaping up magnificently. Look at the great function. With a burnt tail, he clearly crosses the gate of view. This refers to an old story or myth about a great golden carp who is leaping up a multiple-tiered series of waterfalls, going against the current. All the other fish are going downstream, right? That's the easy way. But the bestower of fearlessness is leaping above each of these waterfalls. And as she leaps across the top one, a bolt of lightning zaps her tail, burns it. And she's transformed into a dragon. Isn't that nice? It's not unlike that. But that clouds and thunder accompanying, are those the kleshas? Are those our entanglements? Or is that the universe nodding in agreement, rising to meet us as we stand on the ground of reality? Are those different? And now this beautiful fish will not agree to be sunk in a pickle jar. Mm-mm. And so to be gentle when meeting the tyrant, to be firm when meeting the indulgent one, to be fierce when meeting the tyrant, to be gentle when meeting the indulgent one. There's not a fixed rule. And what does that mean? It means we have to be very attentive. We have to be paying attention. We cannot carry a rule into this moment of truth, because it is not fixed. If we are fixed, we cannot meet it. We are not fixed. That's the basic deal. But we believe ourselves to be. And that belief has the power to make it a reality in our body and mind. And therein lies our struggle. And so, someone used to facing adversity, we have to face it, but now maybe in a different way than before. In the Dharma, with practice, skillfully. Sometimes firm, sometimes gentle. Sometimes leaping forward, sometimes staying put, being patient. And sometimes not knowing what to do. Have you ever been there? Not knowing what to trust, not knowing what the right way forward is. If you haven't, then you should get going. Because that happens a lot. We're not sure because we're on new ground. We're facing something we've not faced before. We are trying to practice it in a way we have not practiced before. It's not entirely clear. That's why having courage is so important, to not wait until everything is clear, until you have complete confidence. Otherwise, we will not take many steps. The footnote to that line about facing adversity says, accepts disgrace like glory, looks on defeat as life. In other words, when we fall, we fall. When we hurt someone, we atone, we repair, we learn. When we succeed, okay. When you come out, Xuefeng says, then I'll tell you. At that point, you'll know. At that point, you will have seen what needs to be seen about that net. But still, we have to, it seems, being human beings as we are, it seems that we have to get entangled in order to free ourselves. Everybody would like it to be otherwise. Does it have to be this way? People often ask. Do we have to get deluded before we can realize enlightenment? Pretty much. Because remember, being deluded simply means not seeing things clearly as they are. But we're seeing them from the relative truth. We're seeing them as our senses seem to present reality to us. Now, of course, there have been a whole lot of messages and social conditioning and experiences that have, you know, imputed all kinds of notions in our head about what is and what isn't. But the basic sense of things being separate and distinct makes sense, given the fact that I'm sitting here looking at you and you're sitting here looking at me. What other conclusion would we come to on our own? Right, that's true, but that's not actually real. Not likely that we would just come to that conclusion on our own. But the fact that proceeding on that conclusion that you and I are distinctly distinct and using that as the basis and then seeing how that works out, if you think that you are in the living experiment, and the thesis of that experiment that you're putting to the test is separate and distinct, autonomous, separate satellites in separate orbits, then the evidence of the experiment is it's not working. Right? We don't need another study. So that should send us back to the original thesis, to the suppositions. Life is not a contest. There is no trophy for the greatest suffering, for the smallest self, for the largest heart, for the clearest mind. Just be true. Be true to the reality before your eyes and discover what that is again and again, and that we develop the courage and the patience to hold us there when we would rather pull back. To be true to yourself. Dada Rishi used to say that all the time, trust yourself. And I thought, I don't know. Like, what does that mean? What am I trusting in the multitude of voices and impulses and desires that are arising? Which of those are trustworthy? And implicit in what he was saying was, you figure that out. You find that out. To trust ourselves is ultimately to trust our original nature, is to trust our capacity, or just that we have but a nature and our capacity to realize that. You know, just the simple and profound practice of facing this moment just as this moment. So just think about, particularly those newer to sessions, but maybe for those who have done a lot of sessions, how many times this week, and we have only on Wednesday. Have you thought forward to later in the day, how much time there's left in the day, or how much sitting there's left in the day, or how many days there's left in the week, and felt that accumulation, right? Because usually we think of that in moments when there's a little bit of struggle, or a lot of struggle, right? And that accumulation, oh, it's all reaching out ahead of you. The mountain is getting larger. What's actually happening, right? That's the proliferation. It's not real. That's not what's actually happening. What's happening is something that's being missed right here. And to trust that much, to trust the moment that much, that you let go of all of that, and you don't have to manage session. You don't have to manage your session. In a sense, that's what the schedule does. It sets it all up so that we can actually just experience one moment after the next. That's all. And then see what happens. See what appears before you. See what doesn't. Sancheng's exalted fame over the four seas. You know, in these teachings talk about here is praising. Hongzhou is praising Sangshen, but he's really doing that. Why is he doing that? Expression of gratitude, expression of respect, reverence, yes, that's important. But he's really doing it for us. He's really talking about you and me. The teacher is always talking about you and me. Who is their peer? Zhuefeng stands alone. The eight winds blowing do not move him. The eight winds are the worldly concerns, fame and disrespect, gain and loss, and so on. No longer lifted up and pushed down by all of those winds. Know yourself. And the seven-point mind training by Pumunkhya Rinpoche. It says, practice unflinchingly. Be steady. Don't retreat. Practice ceaselessly. Don't be boastful. Really, this is nothing special. Being free of suffering, bringing forth happiness and joy. It's our birthright. Don't be short-tempered. One step, one awareness, one practice. That's all. Don't make a short-lived attempt. It doesn't end with session. It doesn't end with a deep experience. It actually doesn't end. Life is practice. And finally, don't expect applause. That's one of the aspects of practice. We're in silence, we're turning in, we're practicing together, we're in intimate contact, we're in solitude. All of that is happening at the same time. And we might meet someone with a bow. We might do something that is seen and appreciated. We might do something that is not seen and not appreciated. Don't expect applause. You are sufficient. One good action is one good action. It is sufficient. One period of Zazen is complete unto itself. However you experience it, it's not dependent on what we consider the quality of our zazen. We live and die. We dance and mourn. Within the quality of our zazen, our opinion of it. That's what we're trying to break free of. That. And so when it's hard and you practice hard, when it's soft and you practice soft, when it's quiet and you practice quiet, when it's robust and you practice robust, can that be enough to show us the totality? It has been for the hundreds and thousands of people who've come before us. It can be for us if we will allow it.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.